In 2004, Kucinich posted single digits in most primary elections, including his home state of Ohio, yet stayed in the race. While awaiting a federal indictment in an extensive bribery case, Louisiana Representative William Jefferson won a contentious runoff election yesterday. Jefferson defeated fellow Democrat Karen Carter, taking 57% of the vote to his opponent's 43%. But Jefferson may have put himself in the position of facing criminal bribery charges as a congressman rather than a private citizen by pursuing a ninth term in Congress. Both Jefferson and Carter promised to help repair the lingering devastation of Hurricane Katrina. Carter also reminded voters of Jefferson's involvement in a scandal that included allegations that FBI agents found $90,000 in bribe money stashed in Jefferson's freezer. Jefferson has been accused of taking bribes from a company seeking contracts in the Nigerian telecommunications market. He has denied doing anything wrong and has not been charged.
Coordinated events in Seattle, Tacoma, and Olympia, Washington, took place this weekend to support current U.S. Army war resisters at Fort Lewis. Free Speech Radio News' Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle.
As part of a national day of action called by the organization Courage to Resist, anti-war activists gathered to demonstrate support for three U.S. Army soldiers who have refused to serve in Iraq, Lieutenant Aaron Watada, Specialist Suzanne Swift, and Sergeant Kevin Benderman. Events were supported by Veterans for Peace, Stand Up Seattle, the Answer Coalition, and the Washington State Green Party. Stand Up Seattle activist Aaron Alexander demonstrated on behalf of war resistors at Westlake Center in Seattle.
We're sending postcards to Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, and they read, "War doesn't take a holiday. Troops home now. Free all war resistors."
Despite the Democratic Party's new majority in Congress, Alexander says that the war in Iraq will not be brought to an end until anti-war groups are able to organize and apply immense public pressure on their elected representatives in Washington, D.C. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
The Supreme Court ruled against the oil and gas industry today in a dispute over how many years into the past the government can reach to collect money for leases on federal land. In a 7-0 decision, the court refused to limit the number of years the government can reach back to collect unpaid royalties. The ruling also applies to administrative proceedings the Interior Department brought about against two companies. At issue is whether a federal law imposing a 6-year time limit for the government to file lawsuits based on federal contracts also applies to administrative orders. 10 years ago, the Interior Department's Minerals Management Service ordered BP America Production Company and ARCO to pay to cover royalty deficiencies on coal bed methane. The government's administrative claim was based on royalties allegedly owed going back more than 8 years from the time the Interior Department demanded the money.
Christian leaders joined other faith leaders over the weekend in prayer for the ongoing genocide in Darfur, the Darfur region of Western Sudan. The weekend of prayers for Darfur, so-called, urged prayers to call attention to the estimated 400,000 deaths and 3.5 million people affected by the conflict in Darfur. The National Association of Evangelicals, the nation's largest evangelical organization, encouraged churches to include a prayer for Darfur in the weekly services. Many churches also help promote awareness of the Darfur situation by hanging a banner reading, "Call to Your Conscience," outside their church.
Think outside the sludge. Authorities have confirmed 61 cases of E. coli among people who ate at Taco Bell restaurants. The first case has been reported in New York City. The person ate at a Taco Bell in Staten Island. Most of the cases have been reported in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Delaware. Taco Bell officials say they've determined that scallions were the likely cause of the outbreak. The company says it has switched produce suppliers.
Three Michigan universities asked a federal court today to delay a new state ban on public affirmative action programs until after the year's admissions and financial aid cycles. The University of Michigan, Michigan State University, and Wayne State University want to complete those cycles with the same standards that were in effect earlier this year. The voter-approved initiative to ban the use of race and gender preferences in university admissions and government hiring is scheduled to take effect December 22nd. The new law already has been challenged by a pro-affirmative action group that is trying to stop the law from taking place. University of Michigan President Mary Sue Coleman said that scholarship and financial aid promises would be kept and that no one on campus would lose a job because of the new law.
All across Massachusetts, men and women who have spent years on the streets finally have what they've always wanted, a house key. Part of an innovative national trend in homeless care, the Housing First models are taking the chronically homeless out of the shelter system by offering permanent housing in a group setting where access to medical, mental health, and substance services are never far away. In Massachusetts, the systems receive private, federal, and state funding, including the Home and Healthy for Good grant money cut, and then restored to the budget by Governor Mitt Romney last month. Advocates believe permanently housing the homeless could dramatically cut costs by reducing hospitalizations, emergency room visits, and arrests. The model also helps social workers find more appropriate services for homeless people, some of whom are too ill to live in an emergency shelter. In exchange for the new homes, tenants are expected to have a case manager and a self-sufficiency plan. Where possible, rents are leveraged at a rate of 30% of the individual's monthly income.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan delivered one last message to the world, and he directed that message to the United States. Annan singled out the U.S. for its foreign policy and said the U.S. is the critical component to implement change. Free Speech Radio News' Leanne Caldwell reports.
In a speech at the Harry Truman Presidential Library in Missouri, Kofi Annan didn't reflect on his tenure. Instead, he laid out ideals for the United Nations to strive for in the future. Throughout his speech, he quoted Harry Truman, the American president, instrumental in shaping the vision of the United Nations.
Human rights and the rule of law are vital to global security and prosperity. As Truman said, and I quote again, we must once and for all prove by our acts conclusively that right is might. Right is might. That's why this country has historically been in the vanguard of global human rights movement. But that lead can only be maintained if America remains true to its principles, including in the struggle against terrorism. When it appears to abandon its own ideals and objectives, its friends abroad are naturally troubled and confused.
Throughout his speech, Annan spoke about the need for a return to multilateral concern, especially when it involves the use of military force.
And states need to play by the rules towards each other, as well as towards their own citizens. That can sometimes be inconvenient, but ultimately what matters is not inconvenience, it is doing the right thing. No state can make its own actions legitimate in the eyes of others. When power, especially military force, is used, the world will consider it legitimate only when convinced that it is used and is being used for the right purpose, for broadly shared aims in accordance with broadly accepted norms.
Annan did not name the United States directly, but alluded to the superpower that invaded Iraq in 2003. The Security Council did not pass a resolution authorizing force against Iraq. In 2004, Annan called the U.S. invasion illegal and a single-handed decision made by the United States. In his speech Monday, Annan also called for wealthy countries to allow for more equal representation of poor countries. He said it would be most effective at the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and at the U.N. Security Council. In a question-and-answer period after his speech, Kofi Annan rejected any interpretation of his speech as criticism of the United States. Instead, he called it a plea for leadership.
Americans did so much. You did so much in the last century to build an effective multilateral system with the United Nations at its heart. Do you need it less today? And does it need you less than 60 years ago? Surely not. More than ever, today Americans, like the rest of humanity, need a functioning global system through which the world's people can face global challenges together. And in order to and in order to function more effectively, the system still cries out for far-sighted American leadership.
Kofi Annan will conclude 10 years as Secretary General on December 31st. Ban Ki-moon of South Korea will be his successor. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Hundreds of protesters gathered in front of Sudan's embassy in Washington on Sunday to protest against widespread violence in the Darfur region. According to officials with the non-governmental charity organization Save Darfur, protesters sounded rape alarms and blew whistles to draw attention to the violence in Darfur. The Sudanese government is accused of unleashing Arab militiamen known as the Janjaweed in the remote western province. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in Darfur's three-year war. More than 2 million others have been displaced. Sunday's protest occurred on the 59th anniversary of the UN General Assembly's adoption and proclamation of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Seriously ill patients could get experimental medicines under proposed federal guidelines released today. That also would clarify when drug companies could charge for the medicine. The revised guidelines lay out in the greater detail when unapproved drugs could be available to patients to treat a life-threatening or serious disease or condition. The FDA would have to be satisfied that the potential benefit of the treatment justifies its potential risks. If adopted, drugs could be available during all stages of drug development, including initial phase 1 testing. The revised guidelines would further describe all circumstances in which access would be allowed, including to small groups of patients. A drug could also be made available on a wider basis according to the seriousness of the disease it targets and the number of patients involved.
Congress voted Thursday to significantly increase federal funding for research into identifying the cause of autism, now diagnosed in 1 in 166 children. The Senate, acting a day after House passage, approved iVoice legislation that which authorizes $945 million over 5 years for autism research, screening, and treatment. The bill, which goes into the president for his signature, would increase federal funding for autism by 50%. The legislation provides the National Institute of Health with a list of possible research areas related to autism spectrum disorder. Research possibilities include an examination of whether the increase in autism diagnosis is caused by environmental factors.
The Clark County coroner has rescheduled an inquest of the October homicide death of a robbery suspect who struggled with Las Vegas police. Coroner Michael Murphy says the proceeding was postponed from this Friday to January 11th and 12th due to scheduling conflicts. Murphy has ruled the October 19th death of James Lewis was due to cocaine intoxication, with contributing factors including heart disease and what he called police, quote, restraining procedures, end quote. A lawyer representing Lewis's family says he intends to file a federal wrongful death lawsuit against police based on the case. Police have said Lewis struggled with officers who chased him and used tasers to subdue him after an early morning robbery of a neighborhood lounge in northeast Las Vegas.
A federal judge's ruling today ensured a dispute over classified information would not derail former White House aide I. Lewis Scooter Libby's perjury and obstruction trial. U.S. District Judge Rebbe B. Walton accepted Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald's proposal to limit the details Libby and his attorneys can discuss. Libby is accused of lying to investigators about his conversations with reporters regarding a CIA operative. He says he has more pressing issues on his mind and wants to discuss classified intelligence about terrorist threats and foreign nuclear programs to bolster that argument. Prosecutors had accused Libby of demanding so much sensitive information that the government could not safely release it, leading to a dismissal. The trial is set for next month.
Dubai Ports World, whose planned takeover of major U.S. port operations ignited a political firestorm earlier this year, has agreed to sell those operations to AIG Global Investment Group. The U.S. operations at six major U.S. seaports were valued at approximately $700 million. The deal also involves stevedoring operations at 16 locations along the eastern seaboard and Gulf Coast, and a passenger terminal in New York City. The Bush administration has agreed last January to allow DP World to acquire the U.S. port operations. As soon as the deal became public, however, they were fiercely attacked by members of both political parties. As a result of the public pressure, DP World ultimately agreed to sell off the U.S. assets.
Peace activist Cindy Sheehan and three other women have been convicted of trespassing, but acquitted of other charges after being arrested earlier this year during a war protest. Sheehan and the others were arrested in March in New York City over a war petition they tried to deliver to the U.S. mission to the United Nations. Prosecutors say the four women ignored police orders to disperse after they were turned away while trying to deliver the petition to officials across the street from the UN. After being convicted on the trespassing charges, the judge in the case sentenced the protesters to a conditional discharge, which means they are not to get arrested for another 6 months. They were also ordered them to pay $95 in court surcharges. The four were acquitted of disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and obstructing government administration.
Virginia's attorney general said today he will seek legislation requiring convicted sex offenders to register their online identities to help the site MySpace.com block access. If enacted, Virginia would be the first state to require registration of email addresses and instant messaging identities on the state's sex offender registry. Parents, school administrators, and law enforcement authorities have grown increasingly worried that teens are at risk on MySpace and other social networking sites. MySpace announced plans last week to develop technologies designed to help block convicted sex offenders by checking profiles against government registries. Skeptics say such technologies will address only part of the problem, as much of the danger comes from sexual predators who have never been convicted and are thus not on the database.
Might I recommend blogspot.com as a safe alternative? The time is 5:28, and now, time for another Half Lynn Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
First, the good news. In response to voter disgust with the corrupt, money-soaked ties between lobbyists and lawmakers, Speaker-to-be Nancy Pelosi has pledged that the new Democratic majority will deliver, quote, the most honest, most open, and most ethical Congress in history. Bravo! Now, the bad news. Even as Pelosi was pledging, some other Democratic leaders quietly began weaseling. They're saying, hey, ethics reform is a nice political issue, but let's not let it get in the way of doing business. So instead of stout reform, the initial package put forth by the Democrats is more reform light. It bans members from going on lobbyist-paid junkets, taking gifts from lobbyists, and getting freebie trips aboard corporate jets. It also requires lobbyists to report all contacts with members, and it puts restrictions on former members who become lobbyists. All good things. But effective reform, reform with real teeth, requires an independent watchdog to enforce ethics rules. And, most importantly, it requires public financing of congressional campaigns to sever the corrupt link between big money and lawmakers. This is where several of the Democrats are balking. For example, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who will chair the committee overseeing reform proposals, dismisses the idea of an independent ethics watchdog. Quote, as to whether we need to create a new federal bureaucracy to enforce the rules, I would hope not. Hope, however, is not action, and voters made it clear on November 7th that they expect action from the new Democratic majority, lest Democrats become a minority again. This is Jim Hightower saying, back to the good news, nearly all of the newly elected Democrats, along with such incumbents as Senators Barack Obama and Dick Durbin, are pushing for real reform. To help them push, call Common Cause, 202-833-1200. 202-833-1200.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 p.m. following this newscast. At 7, it's Time Sound with Kevin Barry. Rain showers early with overcast skies later in the day with a high of 49 degrees and a 60% chance of precipitation. And for all you folks living in the Columbia Gorge, expect rain showers with a high of 43 degrees.
Chile's former dictator, General Augusto, who ruled Chile with an iron fist for 17 years, is dead. He died Sunday afternoon at Santiago's military hospital of massive heart failure. His death led to shows of grief and jubilation on Santiago's streets. Hardcore supporters wept openly, while opponents and victims of human rights abuses under the Pinochet regime danced in the streets and uncorked bottles of champagne in celebration. FSRN's Jorge Garatón reports.
The sounds of jet fighters slamming their rockets into Chile's presidential palace on September 11, 1973, ushered one of the most brutal dictatorships in the Western Hemisphere. The man who ordered the bombing of Chile's seat of democratic power, Army General Augusto Pinochet, died following a massive system and heart failure. His death was quickly mourned by hardcore supporters who openly wept outside Santiago's military hospital. Meanwhile, some 5,000 people gathered to celebrate his passing at the presidential palace, which was quickly dispersed by a police officer who began to disperse the happy crowd with sprays from a water cannon. Later, riot police moved in, causing the havoc on Santiago's main thoroughfare lasting into the evening. That is the legacy of Pinochet, a country divided by the scars of 17 years of military dictatorship, where one group benefited and the vast majority suffered. In this interview that took place just a few days after the September 11, 1973 coup, Pinochet says, with the help of an interpreter, that it was President Salvador Allende's doing. That is why he ordered the bombs to fall on the presidential palace and tanks to ram its main doors.
El día 11 de septiembre,
on September the 11th,
se llevó efecto en forma coordinada.
It took place in a coordinated way.
Primeramente, un apresto.
A preparation.
Enseguida una comunicación al señor presidente de la República.
Then a communication to the Mr. Allende.
Para que entregara el mando de la nación sin derramamiento de sangre.
So he will relate the power without any loss of blood.
Sin embargo, el señor Allende se negó a aceptar esta proposición.
But Mr. Allende refused.
Soon after that date, a violent repression ensued that left some 3,000 people murdered or disappeared, at least 30,000 known victims of torture, and nearly a million political and economic exiles. But supporters say it was all worth it because Pinochet prevented a civil war and from Chile becoming another Cuba. This afternoon at Santiago's Military Academy, in a line that turned five times over the distance of a football field, supporters chanted, sang, mourned the passing of their hero, the man who saved Chile from communism. A woman waiting in line with flowers and a cap with Pinochet's name scribbled on it explains the feelings most of his supporters.
There has been a lot of injustice towards Pinochet, and he couldn't defend himself in many things. As Napoleon, as many heroes, time will say, I think that he deserves a state funeral, and he was a hero for me and for many people.
Yesterday, the government and President Michelle Bachelet, who was herself tortured under the Pinochet dictatorship, have only granted a military funeral. In Santiago's East End, in a placid neighborhood, is the offices of the Association of Family of the Detained and Disappeared. Norma Matus, a woman in her mid-70s with a picture of her son Carlos, missing since 1975, hopes that now, with Pinochet's passing, justice finally does its work.
La verdad está, si son más de 30 años, de más tienen antecedentes. The truth is there, and it has been for more than 30 years. They have all the information with them. The least that I hope for is that my son's remains are returned to me. This government cannot hand honors to an assassin and hope that people will mourn him. This will continue dividing the country.
On the busy Santiago streets, pedestrians hurry from one point to another. I stopped one to ask his opinion of Pinochet's passing. He says he's not happy because despite his death, Pinochet's legacy lives on. The free market policies are still in place. He says today's Chile is one built by Pinochet.
Muere. Muere parte de la historia, pero una muerte física porque
part of history dies, but it's a physical death because Pinochet is alive in the economic model. In the new Chile, full of debtors to banks and retail stores in an animal-free market system that is rotting the country, and that is Pinochet. This model has been justified by the current center-left government. So I have an odd feeling because this guy left this life without facing trial, because the ruling coalition allowed it to happen.
Pinochet's policies live on despite the end of his regime in 1990. The free market economic policies are in place. The large economic gap between rich and poor, market-regulated pensions, and unregulated labor market, a large gap between private and public health care and education. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Syria and Iraq have reopened their embassies in each other's capitals, ending a diplomatic boycott which has lasted more than 20 years. The two neighbors severed ties during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, but Syria has adopted a friendlier approach in the last few months, analysts say. Officials in Damascus say they want to stop an Iraqi civil war and prevent the disintegration of the country. No ambassadors have been appointed so far. The ceremonies were conducted by visiting deputy foreign ministers from each side.
There are many places that front on same-sex marriages, but one African country is thinking of going well beyond that. Nigeria is considering a bill that would ban any form of association among gays. Everything from sharing a restaurant meal to going to gay clubs would become illegal. Penalties would include prison terms of up to 5 years. The bill is expected to pass in Nigeria, where the gay community generally keeps to themselves and few are willing to come out against the plan. It's already illegal to engage in homosexuality in Nigeria, with penalties ranging from jail to death.
After more than 11 days of continuous street protests in downtown Beirut, the Lebanese opposition movement stepped up their campaign to oust the current pro-Western government. Analysts say what is at stake after last summer's 34-day war with Israel is the future legitimacy of the ailing Lebanese democracy. FSRN's Jackson Allers spent the last 2 weeks with members of the two political camps in Lebanon and files this report.
Over the weekend, opposition leaders continued to urge the massive gathering of protesters to remain steadfast in their calls for a new government. Hezbollah leader Saeed Hassan Nasrallah addressed the crowd late last week in an attempt to boost morale for the opposition movement heading into the weekend. It worked, at least temporarily. The crowd was nearly as big as the estimated 800,000 that gathered in downtown Beirut last week. The Lebanese army said it was unprecedented in size. Hezbollah leader Saeed Hassan Nasrallah.
Does any Lebanese or Arab expect us to shut up when the government doesn't care about making decisions for Lebanon? Decisions made under the control of the U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Feltman and behind him Condoleezza Rice? We want a national Lebanese government that's not controlled by foreign elements.
Indeed, both political camps are blaming the other of encouraging foreign interference in domestic politics. The staunchly anti-Syrian March 14 coalition that came to power in 2005 after the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri blames the opposition of being stooges for Syria and Iran. They claim the opposition is trying to orchestrate a coup. Maria Abdel Nour was on the streets of downtown Beirut during last week's protest. A Christian from the opposition, Free Patriotic Movement, She also participated in the huge March 14 demonstrations against Syria in 2005. She says she lost faith in Prime Minister Fouad Siniora's government after the 34-day war with Israel.
Nobody is going to govern the country if they are not getting power from the ground up. They cannot hold their seats. And if you are getting support only from the outside, like from Jacques Chirac and George Bush, then it's best for you to go and be with them because you do not have support here. The country is $44 billion in debt. How are my children going to pay for this? After this war, they're going to tell us it's $100 billion.
Timur Goksal says the current political divide in Lebanon is more like a new Cold War playing out in the Middle East between those aligned with Western governments and those that are not. But Goksal, a political analyst at American University of Beirut and former spokesperson for the United Nations Interim Forces in southern Lebanon, says that a civil war is still not likely.
A civil war is not that easy to wage. You could have security incidents, yes, I think they will happen. But a war, especially the kind of a civil war we had in Lebanon, which I lived through here, is not that easy. First of all, the actors have changed. The political scene in Lebanon now is not what it was in 1975. Moreover, there is a scarcity of foreign sponsors at the moment. Civil war is an expensive game.
What is clear is that Lebanon is paralyzed right now because of the demonstrations. Commerce in the downtown center of Beirut, the commercial hub of Lebanon, is at a standstill. And according to observers, the longer the political impasse continues, the more Lebanon's economy will suffer. Selou Ashadi is a Sunni Muslim from the Tari Ashdidi neighborhood in Beirut, a neighborhood that has seen clashes between pro-government Sunna and anti-government Shia Muslims recently. A supporter of the current government, Ashadi works at a coffee shop in downtown Beirut. Her cafe had experienced a boom during the last week of protests.
So is this government representative?
You can't ask me this because the whole country doesn't know whether it is representative. How am I supposed to answer that question?
Political analyst Timur Goksal says he expects little governmental change in the current round of political upheaval. Goksal says that the sectarian system in Lebanon is here for good, regardless of what outside political actors envision for Lebanon's political future. And as Arab leaders arrived in Beirut in an attempt to break the political deadlock, Hezbollah leader Syed Hassan Nasrallah has reportedly endorsed an Arab League compromise deal that would give the opposition veto power in the Lebanese cabinet, something Prime Minister Fouad Siniora and his allies have rejected thus far. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
African Union peacekeepers killed three Darfur rioters when a crowd of angry refugees threatened to break into their base in the town of El Janaya, a UN official said today. It was the first time peacekeepers have killed Darfur civilians, marking new deterioration in the war-torn region of western Sudan. In a separate incident, the African Union reported today that gunmen have kidnapped two of its peacekeepers the night before. African Union peacekeepers have been deployed in Darfur since mid-2004 on a mission to protect civilians in a three-year conflict that has killed more than 200,000 people and driven 2.5 million from their homes. But the forces' relations with Darfur's population has long been tense, with refugees frequently complaining it does not protect them from Janjaweed. The 7,000-member African Union force has been too understaffed and under-equipped to halt increasing violence in Darfur.
A Marine stationed in Camp Pendleton has become the first female officer killed while fighting in Iraq. Major McClung, was a public affairs officer for the Marine Corps, and over the last few months was worked in Iraq as a liaison between the press and troops on the front lines. According to the Department of Defense, McClung died while supporting combat operations in Al Anbar province on Wednesday. Reports that she was killed by an improvised explosive device in Ramadi were not confirmed. Military officials say McClung was assigned to the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force Headquarters Group.
The Department of Defense will abandon plans to use emergency powers to fast-track a controversial $100 million legal compound at the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Department officials now say they will wait for congressional approval before moving forward with the extensive courthouse project, intended to try detainees from the Bush administration's war on terrorism. FSRN's Erica Volas reports from Sydney.
We're calling on our government to do one simple thing. Make a phone call to your mate, George W. Bush, and ask that David Hicks come home and spend Christmas with his family.
Green Senator Kerry Nettle neatly summed up the sentiment of the crowd at the Sydney protest. David Hicks is a 31-year-old Australian man whose exploration of Islam led him to Afghanistan, where he spent time training at an Al-Qaeda-run camp. His father alleges that whilst trying to leave Afghanistan in 2001, he was picked up by the Northern Alliance and then sold to US forces and from there sent to Guantanamo Bay. However, he has broken no Australian law, and so far no evidence points to him planning a terror attack. 5 years on, there's growing unease about the seeming inaction by the Australian government to seek Hicks's return. Artist Lucinda Scuttlebug attended the rally and had this to say about Hicks's plight.
I'm upset that other countries have brought their guys home and we haven't, and I'm ashamed, so it's time to do something and get out, stand up for what you believe in.
Those involved in civil rights campaigning say momentum is growing, and they point to the significance of a number of government backbenchers joining the voices of church leaders, union groups and civil libertarians calling for Hicks's immediate return to Australia. Agnes Chong from the Australian Muslim Rights and Civil Advocacy Network gave her perspective.
I think people are sitting up and paying attention, and also attorneys general of all the states and territories have come together to sign a declaration saying that, that David Hicks should be afforded his rights.
But Australia's Federal Attorney General, Philip Ruddock, maintains that David Hicks will be charged under the Second Military Commission in a matter of weeks and that he will receive a fair trial.
We're pressing and continuing to press the American government to bring him to trial as quickly as possible.
Meanwhile, the Australian government maintains that for now he must remain at Guantanamo. They say he can't be returned because he's broken no Australian law. However, Hicks's US military lawyer, Major Michael Morey, says that appeals against the second military tribunal could see David's trial put off until the end of 2008. Mr. Ruddock has also claimed that David Hicks has brought the delays on himself because of continued appeals against the US military tribunals. But David's Australian lawyer, David McLeod, says that it's an appalling suggestion that David Hicks should submit himself to a trial process that denies basic rights enjoyed under Australian and US law.
So what the attorney is really saying is that David Hicks ought to have agreed to be dealt with by a commission that was ultimately found by the United States Supreme Court to be illegal. He also says that David Hicks should have agreed to be put before a commission that was capable of receiving evidence obtained under torture.
There are also growing concerns about David's mental and physical state. He's being held in Camp 5 under solitary confinement 23 hours a day. Mamdou Habib, also Australian, spent 3 years at Guantanamo and he says he was subjected to torture there until he was finally released in 2005 with no charges against him. He says David's mental state is in real danger.
Any country they take care of their own citizens except the John Howard government. David Hicks, today, in danger.
Now David Hicks's legal team is exerting pressure on another front, challenging John Howard's government in the federal court over its claim that it is unable to seek Hicks's return to Australia because he has committed no Australian crime. His legal team is claiming that not only is this irrelevant, but it's unconstitutional. Hicks's Australian lawyer, David McLeod, says that under these grounds, they want him immediately returned to Australia. This is Erica Voles in Sydney, reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
In other detainee news, mobilizations continue to pressure the state government of Oaxaca and the federal government of Mexico to release the more than 200 people arrested in Oaxaca City since November 25th. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
Thousands of people marched in Oaxaca City yesterday to demand the release of over 200 people detained in recent weeks during federal and state police operations. Relatives of the detained have been denouncing irregularities in many of the cases, from extremely high bills to the use of torture to extract confessions. Human rights organizations say that many of the 141 prisoners transferred to the federal penitentiary in the state of Nayarit continue to be held incommunicado. Some senators from the opposition PRD party have thrown their weight behind the demands of the protesters. Even Oaxacan Governor Ulises Ruiz has had to concede that innocent people have been imprisoned during the conflict. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores.
Islamic authorities in a Malaysian state believe they have found the secret of family love, women singing lullabies to their children and husbands. The government of Kelantan, the only Malaysian state to be ruled by an Islamic fundamentalist party, will organize this month a lullaby contest to find the mother who can best induce sleep in her children and husband with songs, the Star newspaper said Thursday. The contest aims to promote family togetherness according to Islam's tenets, especially in homes with two working parents. A total of 42 couples will have entered the contest, which will begin preliminary rounds soon. A final round with 10 shortlisted couples will be held on December 23rd.
South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, appointed by the United Nations to head a fact-finding mission into Gaza, today accused Israel of blocking the investigation into an Israeli attack in October that resulted in the deaths of 18 members of one family. FSRN Syed Benour reports.
The special commission appointed last month by the United Nations Human Rights Council was supposed to have submitted its findings to the United Nations by Friday. But until now, they have been unable to even enter the country to begin their investigation. Archbishop Desmond Tutu and other members of the commission blame Israel for blocking their entry. Israeli Foreign Ministry spokesman Mark Regev stated that the Israeli government was still deciding on whether to allow the UN commission entry permits. But commission members, including Tutu, say that the delay has cost them their mission. Mustafa Barghouti, a Palestinian legislator.
Israel has made one of the most shameful acts in its history by preventing Desmond Tutu from reaching Gaza. That shows you that Israel has crossed all the red lines, thinking that it is totally impunitive to international law, humanitarian law, and respect for human rights.
Meanwhile, the results of another investigation on the behavior of the Israeli forces in Lebanon during the war in July was released today. The investigation conducted by the Israeli government found that Israeli commanders were unclear and partial in their orders to troops. Israeli forces killed over 1,200 civilians during the month-long war in Lebanon in July. For FSRN from IMEMC.org, this is Saed Banoura in Beit Sahour, Palestine.
Economist Mohamed Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize on Sunday for his program to lift the poor through tiny loans. Yunus shared the award with his Grameen Bank, which for more than two decades has helped impoverished people start businesses by providing loans known as microcredit. Yunus is the first Nobel winner from Bangladesh. Nobel Committee Chairman Ole Danbolt Mjohis said the award was partially intended as a nod to the Islamic world in an era where Muslims are often demonized because of terrorism. In Yunus's home district, several thousand people squatted or stood around a large screen put up at a stadium. People clapped and shouted, "Long live Bangladesh," when he spoke a few words in Bengali, the national language, during his acceptance speech.
15 years after nearly being annihilated by Saddam Hussein, almost half of Iraq's fabled marshlands of Mesopotamia have been restored with water and wildlife. The restoration arrives thanks to a multi-million dollar program managed by the UN Environment Program. Satellite images released this week show that almost 50% of the total area, one of the world's largest wetland ecosystems, has been reflooded. This is in sharp contrast to agency images in 2001 revealing that 90% of the marshlands had already been lost. They were ravaged by a vast drainage operation carried out by Hussein's government after the 1991 Persian Gulf War. Up to 22,000 people living in the area are now getting access to safe drinking water. The program aims eventually to provide clean water for up to 100,000.
The bones of a baby plesiosaur have been recovered from an Antarctic island, scientists reported today. In life, 70 million years ago, the 5-foot-long animal would have resembled Nessie, the long-necked creature reported to inhabit Scotland's Loch Ness. The new fossil skeleton is one of the most complete of its type ever found, researchers said. It will go on display Wednesday at the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology's Museum of Geology. plesiosaurs lived for millions of years in the then warm southern ocean surrounding Antarctica, with adults growing as large as 32 feet long. With diamond-shaped fins, they could fly through the water much as penguins do now. The skeleton was found in an area covered with volcanic ash, leading them to speculate that the plesiosaur was killed in an eruption, either by the blast or by ash dumped in the ocean. That's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 11th, 2006, marking the 1,911th day since Bush made the declaration he'd catch Osama bin Laden dead or alive. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203, or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. And that goes for news tips as well. Call us with your news tips at 503-231-8032 or extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. My name is Mike Monkbold, and I'm your producer and wire editor for tonight's newscast. Tonight's audio editor is Laura Young. Our engineer is Jeff Lovell. The interim KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Noah Eaton. And I'm Mike Monkbold.
And I'm Noah Eaton. And tomorrow at 7 a.m., stay tuned for the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk radio show. At 9 on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg speaks with local writer Jan Barras, author of Jose Builds a Woman, a tale of magic realism set in rural Mexico. At 9:30, Ed speaks with Dylan Schaefer, author of Life, Death, and Bialis, the story of a father and son bonding in a baking class. At 10, Chris Andre interviews Leslie Roach, a legend in the local horse community. For over 20 years, she has saved horses considered beyond hope. At 10:30 on stage and studio, Michelle Schroeder Fletcher hosts a show about Do Jump Theater's holiday show. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. But it's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit listener sponsor and community radio station. Thanks for joining us, and stay cool.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Just enough for the city. Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio. My name is Mary Beth Healy, and I'm your co-host with...
I'm Ken Allen from Oregon Ask Me.
And this is the show about working people and the labor movement. We're thrilled to have tonight as our guests two union members who also serve as members of the Oregon Legislature. And so before our guests come on, which will be in about 10 minutes, Ken and I will chat a little bit about what is on the docket for the 2007 legislature and what's happening with the labor planning, health care, environmental. What do you see is up there, and what should we ask our guests?
You know, I think for organized labor, it's the first time in about 14 years we can look at a legislature controlled by the Democrats and absolutely more labor-friendly group of folks in control. When you don't have control, you oftentimes can't even get hearings for your bills. Committee chairs won't hear a bill, or else they'll have a hearing, but it won't come out of committee. So this provides a kind of a new opportunity for working people and the unions that represent them.
Well, I think that is right. And, we were talking before going on the air about kind of the pent-up anxiety that many progressive organizations in this state have, and how do we maintain getting a lot accomplished and actually delivering for Oregonians without stepping over the line?
You know, the good news for organized labor in this session is we have several members that come straight out of our ranks, not just Diane and Larry that are going to be our guests tonight, but Brad Witt, the former Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO from this Coupouse-Clatskanie area, is a state legislator. And there's, a handful of others that come out of the working class.
It's very true. So, Ken, you sit on the executive board of the AFL-CIO. What is the state Fed looking at in terms of policy proposals for 2007?
Well, first of all, there's things that don't cost money, but that the legislature could do to change laws to give working people better rights, things that help our organizations build. And the two primary things are a bill called the Worker Freedom Act, and it will ban employers from forcing workers to go to meetings where the employer tries to persuade in a heavy-handed way workers about their political beliefs, religious beliefs, or their beliefs around a union. And when workers try to organize unions, it's oftentimes what are held are called captive audience meetings. And the employer will force the workers to go to these meetings and listen to the employer's line. 91% of employers force workers to go to these kind of meetings when there's a union drive. So we will try to pass a bill that makes it so that workers do not have to attend those mandatory meetings. If they're going to have discussions about religious beliefs, political beliefs, or about joining a union, a worker will be able to refuse to go to those kind of meetings. And that's important. Another bill will be one that we've introduced before, and it would prohibit an employer that receives tax breaks, assistance, or has a nonprofit status from the state from spending some of their revenues to hire anti-union consultants in a union election drive. And 82% of the employers hire high-priced consultants at several hundred dollars an hour to fight union organizing drives. And in these drives, they'll subject the workers to harassment and coercion. So we'll pass a bill that simply says that if you're an employer and you get a tax break from the state or a subsidy or have a nonprofit status, you can't use public funds for those purposes.
That's really a good idea, because this whole issue around thwarting people's free choice, as the case were, is really very important, especially when one talks about taxpayer dollars. And I think New York passed something very similar. And you may be interested, Ken, prior to coming to Oregon, as you know and listeners may know, I worked for the Service Employees International Union in Florida. And there was a hospital organizing campaign going on there. And with a public healthcare district, and it was a publicly funded entity. The whole hospital district was publicly funded. And in their budget, the year prior to the organizing that drive, in their miscellaneous category, was maybe like $500,000. The year of the organizing drive, that figure went up to $5 million. And that was 100% taxpayer money used to thwart people's right to to join a union.
The third major piece of legislation that we'll work on getting passed, we introduced in the Senate last session. We actually got it through the Senate, but couldn't get a hearing in the House. And it would call for, in the public sector, when the union tried to organize, if they got a majority of cards signed by the workers, say there's 100 workers, if 51 would sign union cards saying that they designated the union as their bargaining agent, there wouldn't have to be a long election campaign where it would just be the union would be granted recognition and could begin bargaining. The governor went to that policy for state agencies shortly after he became governor, about 3.5 years ago, and this would extend it to local government. And what we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years is that the local governments that don't have unions here in Oregon even fight new unions coming in tooth and nail and do many of the same unethical anti-union things that private employers have done for years. So we'll introduce that piece of legislation. It'll be an AFL-CIO bill backed by all the public sector unions also.
Excellent.
So I think those are three of the big things.
Do you see any defensive issues on the way that folks might have to fight and hold back?
You know, it's interesting because if you asked me that question for the last 8 years, I would have said, well, we're going to have to fight to defend the minimum wage. And we've had to fight to defend the minimum wage in every session. I don't think that'll happen this time with the Democrat control in both the House and the Senate. And, you know, the governor made it clear, for the last couple sessions, that he would veto anything that severely cut the minimum wage. And, you know, I think that would be the same case, too. So, you know, that's been the one major thing we've had to fight. For the building trades unions, they've had some action around trying to change the Little Davis-Bacon Act, which requires prevailing wages be paid on public projects. I don't see that under attack by this session. So I think we'll be able to primarily focus on trying to make life better for working people instead of having to defend things.
What a difference a day makes.
That sure does. I don't know about you, Mary Beth, but when I got up on Wednesday morning after the election, it's the first time...
Wait, you went to bed? Wait a minute.
Yeah, I did this time. It's the first time in 12 or 14 years that I didn't get up and I wasn't upset, you know, severely upset about something. It was a great election for working people, both here in Oregon and, you know, major progress nationally, too. So I think it's a time when... we can go on the offensive. We need to be realistic about what we need and want, but we can look for a brighter day for Oregon workers and their unions and at the workplace.
Well, you know, one thing that that I was really astonished about by the election results was just the manner in which I think Oregonians spoke really, really loudly. We will not tie your hands in terms of budget issues by voting down measures 41 and 48. We will not tie your hands, and we elect you to do a job. We want you to do your job, so we will vote no on term limits. And then, you know, with ballot measure 44, oh, no, yes, by the way, do something about health care. So I really feel like Oregonians sent a very strong message to this incoming legislature about thinking big and bold and being aggressive about delivering for Oregonians.
Yeah, I think the other thing, I think it was a more discerning voter. If you look at some of the campaigns, say the Supreme Court race between Jack Roberts and Virginia Linder, she was far outspent by Jack Roberts, yet she won that race. And I think a lot of people must have spent a lot of time thinking about these elections this time before they cast their vote. The ballot measures reflect that. Some of the levies that were passed around the state.
The library tax.
Yeah, the library levy. Library levies were passed here and in Eugene. Schools did, you know, had a good night. And so I think voters were pretty discerning and were ready for saying that it's time to move forward in this state and not continue to move back. Then if you take a look at the governor's budget that was released last week, you can see that, you know, now is a good opportunity to build Oregon instead of have it torn down.
Yeah, I think the governor made very good arguments during the campaign about the whole issue around investing and that we really have had to divest in many public programs and divest in our schools and healthcare and public safety. And really, now that we're doing better as a state, as the economy continues to improve, making those investments can only mean good things, I think, for working people.
I think there's a couple other areas that we should expect some activity and action in the legislature that organized labor will be pushing. One of them will be an initiative reform, ballot measure reform. We saw again this cycle many, many violations of the current law, and we need to do things to give the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office more of a hammer against those people that are violating the law. And we need to clean things up and make it so that that ballot measure system is a clean system, so that we're not voting on measures where the signatures have been collected fraudulently. No, I think then your specific area of expertise on health care reform should be a major piece of the action. We put on a Senate committee where, it's the universal health care bill introduced, and it'll start with a big focus on kids first, as the governor does, but it is a comprehensive package for all Oregonians. And organized labor will be taking a careful look at that and hopefully supporting that and making sure it's got the elements in it that will make it better for working people in the state.
Excellent. So we are expecting our guests in just a couple of moments. And I'm wondering if we should ask they call in and ask us questions to ask our guests, since they won't be able to call there while together, or continue to think about what the 07 session means. I've heard a lot about the civil rights and the gay rights community looking forward to a reintroduction of Senate Bill 1000, which would have created civil unions in this state. I'm curious what you see coming down in those areas for other constituency groups who helped create this Democratic majority.
Well, I think we have to expect, and we have to expect, because of the pent up kind of demand of progressive organizations, that they're going to have a long list of things that they want to see accomplished. Another area that labor will be working together will be with environmentalists on such things as energy efficiency in state buildings, a program around energy independence. The governor wants to make this state one of the leading states for energy independence. And I think labor and the environmentalists can work on that together.
That's great. That is one of the issues that the House Democrats had in their agenda was biofuels and the economy. And the issue of environmental issues and labor issues are not necessarily mutually exclusive. As we get ready to have our guests, I think I will start with introducing Representative Diane Rosenbaum, who is probably not a stranger to our listenership here, but just for those of them who may not know, Representative Rosenbaum is a retired central office technician for Quest and a 28-year member of her union, the Communication Workers of America. She served as president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women, executive board member of the Oregon AFL-CIO and the Northwest Oregon Labor Council, and is a founding member of the Workers' Rights Board of Jobs with Justice. Representative Diane Rosenbaum, who attended Reed College, is in the beginning of her fifth term in the Oregon House of Representatives for District 42, which I believe we are sitting in her district right now, in southeastern Portland. She recently was elected Speaker pro tem by her Democratic colleagues in the House. And during the 2005 legislative session, she was serving on the House Audits Committee and the House Environment Committees. She's a member of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance, a bipartisan coalition of legislators and advocates promoting issues such as contraceptive equity, paid family leave, and domestic violence prevention. Representative Rosenbaum is president of the National Labor Caucus of State Legislators and serves as a legislative member of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. Diane, it is absolutely a pleasure to have you with us tonight. Welcome to Labor Radio and congratulations.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How does it feel to be in the majority?
Well, it feels very good. It feels like 16 years has been a long time to wait. And I have to tell my friends at KBOO that the first session I ever set foot in the state legislature was 1989. I was much younger then, and I was representing my Communications Workers of America co-workers, and that was the session, the last session, that Democrats were in the majority in both the House and the Senate. And in 1989, the minimum wage was raised by a bipartisan vote of the legislature instead of having to put it on the ballot. The Oregon Health Plan was created that year, and Oregon's landmark family medical leave law that gives people the right to take time off the job when family members are ill or children are born. All those laws passed. So I'm very, very much looking forward to coming back in 2007 and having a session that starts to do some really good things for the people of Oregon.
That's excellent. I want to just pause for a moment, Diane, and introduce Representative Galizio. And he, for KBOO listeners, is a member of the American Federation of Teachers and has taught at Portland Community College's Sylvania campus for 11 years. He transformed the college's speech and debate team into an internationally recognized program. I hope he doesn't score us or grade us on this show. Under his guidance, PCC was recognized 4 times as the top community college debate team in the nation, and his students competed at the prestigious World Universities Debating Championships. Representative Galizio was just reelected to his second term in the Oregon House of Representatives and represents House District 35. He and his wife, who is a family nurse practitioner, live in Tigard. Welcome, Representative Galizio.
Thanks, Mary Beth. How you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. My co-host here is Ken Allen with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees.
Hello, Diane and Larry. Larry, I actually had the pleasure of knocking on doors for you in October, and the line I used was that you were the only teacher in the Oregon House, and we needed 1 out of 60, I thought. Now I see that Ben Cannon's also a teacher, so...
So now there's two.
Well, I appreciate that, Ken. And, you know, I was listening to the show before Diane and myself came on, and I just wanted to reiterate, you know, Ken, you mentioned, you know, knocking on doors, and although, you know, we want to look forward to the legislative session, I think it's really important to look back and to talk about how significant labor was in terms of this election, not just in terms of financial resources, but in terms of grassroots politics, knocking on doors, like you just mentioned, Ken, phone banking. I mean, just, you know, the sort of the feet on the street were absolutely critical and are a primary reason why Diane and I are now sitting in the majority in the House for the first time in 16 years.
Yeah, I agree, and I, you know, I just think about our own phone banks, and I'm getting ready to send letters out to over 400 volunteers that participated in AFSCME activities. So, but that's really what gets folks elected. And you know what? Can either of you comment, I guess, a little bit about the responsibility you now feel about being in the majority? It's a different dynamic. Dynamic, right? Yeah.
Well, sure. I mean, I think it is going to be different, but I have to tell you, Ken, that as long as I've been serving, and that's since 1999, we have been working on really specific, pragmatic proposals to make life better for our constituents and for working people. And so, you know, we have set about now with the ability to actually get some of these things done. Mary Beth earlier talked about ballot measure 44, making use of the state's bulk purchasing power to do something to make prescription drugs more affordable. Well, that was one of the bills that we were working on, the House Democrats, last session, and just couldn't get a vote on it. So we have a really, I think, a great hit-the-ground-running spirit about this, that we are working really hard on proposals on health care, on education, on jobs, on the environment, on public safety. And although you're right that it will be different to have the majority, to be chairing committees, to have our wonderful speaker-elect Jeff Merkley as the presiding officer, I think our commitment to get things done for real people is the same one that we've had since I was first elected. It's just that now we will have more firepower behind the ability to do that.
That's right. You know, the House Democrats have had a real roadmap, not to to coin the phrase that they use on the website. And I wonder if you would each take a little bit of that roadmap and talk about it for KBOO listeners who may not have been to the House Democrats webpage and seen the roadmap for Oregon's future. I mean, I guess maybe I'll start off with what Speaker-elect Merkley's quote was in there, which was, Oregon needs real solutions to make healthcare more affordable, create good jobs, rebuild our education system, and make government more accountable to the people of this state. A new direction, and I think that's what we're talking about now, a new direction for Oregon means new leadership, and Democrats will lead by putting people over politics. And as we list these things out, you know, moving Oregon forward by putting kids first, talk a little bit about healthy kids and the strong schools platforms of the roadmap.
Sure. Well, I'd be happy to start with talking about healthy kids and a couple of our other priorities, and then Larry, maybe you can jump in about some of the public safety and consumer protection items. So the healthy kids plank of our roadmap talks about providing health insurance for every child in the state of Oregon. We think that it is really criminal that we have kids in our state who have no health insurance at all, as well as having 600,000 Oregonians, whether they're kids or adults, who don't have coverage. We think that this is something that we can achieve in 2007. We have a specific plan to extend health care to every child that isn't otherwise covered by private or public insurance. And the governor, as well as the majority in the Senate, are also talking about exactly the same thing. So we think that that's very doable. The governor has talked about using the funding from increasing our cigarette tax, which just would make it equal to what the cigarette tax is across the border in the state of Washington, as the way to pay for that. So we think that's a very practical proposal. And then in terms of education, another big piece of our roadmap is what we call the Strong Schools proposal. And that's a commitment that we will have a full school year and smaller class sizes in every one of our school districts in the state. Right now, you know, people still probably remember how Oregon had the shortest school year in the country a few years ago. We're really committed to not just giving kids enough school days, but also restoring some of the programs that have been cut or chipped away at, as well as higher education. We're very serious about doing something to make tuition more affordable, and I'm sure that's something Larry can talk about since he works at the community college level. And then in addition to that, we are committed to the preschool age, to make Head Start available for every eligible child in the state, because we really believe that education is a continuum that starts before kids get to kindergarten and goes all the way through the right to a college education for everybody that wants it. So those are, I think, two of our major commitments to Oregonians. We already talked about affordable prescription drugs. We want to build on ballot measure 44 and do even more to allow people who don't have adequate prescription drug coverage to tap into the state's bulk purchasing power and do that for small businesses as well. And then in terms of health insurance affordability, we have proposed to have a hearing process for health insurance rate increases so that there actually will be a need for insurance companies to provide data and justify the need to raise health insurance rates. So
that sounds like such an interesting concept. I hope that goes somewhere this session. Larry, what's happening in terms of consumer protection and public safety issues that we can look forward to?
Sure. And I just before I go into those specifics, you know, Mary Beth, in the beginning of the show, you had mentioned the term making investments and investing, and I think that is something that we see as really critical to the future. But in addition to that, I think you'll see the Democrats are also aware that economic times, the economies always shift, and that it's very necessary to have something like a rainy day fund. So I think what you're going to see is some actual real fiscal responsibility. While we are investing in the future in terms of education, healthcare, and public safety. At the same time, we're going to make certain that in the future, if we have a recession, we can do what we can to sort of have some cushion to protect Oregonians so we don't have such a boom and bust economy. But in terms of some of the issues with consumer protection and public safety, you know, Mary Beth and Ken, and I'm sure Diane hears this all the time, I mean, identity theft is a crime that is sort of an equal opportunity crime, and Oregon had been, I think, ninth in the nation in terms of how many people were victims of identity theft. And if anyone has ever had the displeasure of having that happen, they know how time-consuming, expensive, and frustrating it is. And so this session, I think we will be able to pass a comprehensive package, and we're going to be pushing for that. And there are two elements that are specific that, and again, it's part of a larger package I don't have time to get into, but one is just the idea that anytime there is a breach of security, so, for example, in Oregon, we had Providence Hospital lost records or had some records stolen a while back. This just would say that if your records have been compromised, you will have to be notified within a very short period of time so that you can take action. Secondly, the idea of having the ability to do a credit freeze. In other words, you can freeze your credit report so that if you're the type of person that doesn't open accounts all the time and you just have your credit frozen, so if somebody does steal your information, they can't just open up a bunch of credit cards in your name. So I think we'll get that passed. Diane had mentioned previously emergency contraception, and you will see the Democrats push strongly for a kind of a sexual assault victims' rights. In other words, protecting privacy of victims, but also guaranteeing access to emergency contraceptives. I think that's something that you will see, I hope, to come out of this session. And also, you know, still we have this the ongoing a meth epidemic, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the discussion concerning the shortage of the number of state police. So the governor's budget is pushing for, you know, something like 100, 150 new state police, and I think the Democratic members are serious about getting 24/7 patrol so that state police can not merely catch Ken speeding down I-5 going from Portland to Salem, but also, you know, they're stopping drunk drivers and also combating the meth epidemic. So you'll see that what will come out of this session, I think, is much greater investment so we have more state police. So those are two other areas that are really significant.
One of the things I notice in your platform is about, you know, trying to find efficiencies in the agencies. And I know I don't have to remind you two, but it's always a good thing to call on the union leaders to come in and from those agencies, because my members, you know, work in about 20 different state agencies. They can tell you where there's still savings to be found and can pinpoint some of those areas. So I'd encourage you to be looking to that.
One of the things, excuse me, I'm sorry, when we think about efficiencies, and I, as you both know, I'm a little myopic around healthcare issues. However, the Heinz Family Foundation, or Philanthropic Foundation, released a report back in July saying that Oregon could save $17 million if all state agencies just pooled their drug purchases. So this is one area of, I think, efficiency that we can do. But Larry, or Representative Galizia, you brought up the governor's budget, and I want to think about that because it did look like a great pre-Christmas present or pre-holiday gift for many, many people. But when he talks about the Healthy Kids program and tobacco tax, I'm wondering if you think that the 84 cents is, I guess there's two questions. One, is 84 cents enough? And the second, is tobacco taxes the right method philosophically to be funding health care broadly, but kids' health care in particular, or do you think there's a better alternative to fund health care?
Well, I'm certainly always open to ideas. If somebody or some group or one of my colleagues has a great idea in terms of what would be the best sort of funding mechanism, I think you can make a strong argument that to some extent the idea of a cigarette tax and linking it to health care, you can make a logical argument there. So, and the question of 84 cents, is it enough? I mean, my understanding of how that figure was, when we came to that figure, is it's would put us level with Washington State. So concerns about, well, you'd have people sort of going over to Washington to purchase a lot of cigarettes. And also just the amount of money that would be raised would allow us to, you know, I think Diane mentioned 600,000 Oregonians with no health care. I think, 117,000 kids in Oregon with no health care?
Correct.
So it's absolutely critical that, you know, if we want to do preventive medicine and cover kids and have healthy kids, that we have to find a means. And to my mind, it makes sense, and I'm supportive at this point. But Mary Beth, if you have a better idea, I'm all ears.
I think
the Mary Beth, if I could just jump in, sure. I do want to also point out that raising the cigarette tax, we know, is one way to reduce the rate of smoking and do something to just make sure that fewer young people start smoking and that more people are able to quit. My mom actually died of smoking-related heart disease, so it's something I feel very, very strongly about. Some of what that cigarette tax increase would go toward is tobacco prevention programs. So, you know, in addition to the connection with the health-related costs of smoking, we can do something about helping people quit or helping kids to not start to begin with. And I also just want to point out that there is really an embarrassment in Oregon, and that is that we are the only state in the nation, to my knowledge, to actually have reduced our tax on tobacco products. That happened a few years ago due to some shenanigans on the part of the tobacco industry, and so that we actually reduced our cigarette tax by 10 cents a pack. So I'd say it's way past time for us to correct that, and I think that this is something where we will find bipartisan agreement. Republicans and Democrats and Oregonians would say this is really a smart thing to do, and that we can use that money to fund health care and tobacco prevention. So I think it's past time, and we should do it.
I think the other critical thing is that most of those kids are children of working parents in, you know, minimum wage jobs or poorly paid jobs where the employers don't provide decent health care, or the health care is so expensive that the parents can't afford it, they have to go without coverage. I mean, there's tons of working folks. When our unemployment rate has gone down but the number of uninsured has gone up, you know that those are mostly jobs being created that don't provide insurance. So,
yeah, are there thoughts in terms of what the House leadership or the Democratic caucus might be doing in terms of broader health care reform? I just have to look at the Metro section on Saturday. Senate panel drafts broad health care plan. And I guess I'm just curious what happens when that comes to the other side of the building.
Well, I would say that, I'll say this, and I hope this doesn't sound like too much of a politician's answer. I think that this is going to be a session, and not just 2007, but beyond, where many, many ideas for reforming the healthcare system in Oregon are going to be taken very seriously. Obviously, you know, we campaigned on healthcare for all kids. It's something we feel strongly about. We think we can get it done this session. But I think that very many of us want to also see other things happen, and that, you know, Mitch Greenlick, one of our colleagues, State Representative Mitch Greenlick, attempted to put an initiative on the ballot, didn't quite get there this time, to create a right to health care for every Oregonian. So obviously, you know, there are many of us who are committed to health care reform over the long haul. But just speaking for me, I think that we have to start somewhere, and, you know, I don't think that just having a debate about health care is enough. I think we really have to get something done and get started with some practical steps.
I don't think Diane, you sounded like a politician.
No. I would be surprised if Diane could do that.
Can I just chime in here?
Please.
You know, they say states are sort of the laboratories for democracy, and since the federal government has just absolutely failed miserably when it comes to providing basic health care coverage for the citizenry, You're seeing states now trying to move aggressively. And, you know, yes, we're in control as of in terms of the 2007 session, but this has been a long-term set of issues, and it's complex and it's expensive. And I agree with Diane in terms of I think it is really doable in terms of covering kids, and I think that is, it's a moral imperative, and we need to do that, and I think we can do that. To the extent we can come up and craft solutions to strengthen coverage and widen it, I think we need to do that, but we have to be intelligent about how we do these things.
And reduce costs, and I think that's the other key that I think you all probably heard at the doors. I certainly hear it in my day job and what I know just from, you know, public opinion research, that it is the high cost of healthcare that is driving people crazy, right? And so are there other ideas? I think the Insurance Rate Review Board is one mechanism that we can use to get some accountability in the industry to really see where our healthcare dollars are going. And I think, you know, also how healthcare connects with every other issue that members of the public and certainly members of the legislature care about, because it is such a huge piece of the state budget overall.
I want to ask you folks about a couple of issues I raised before you came on, kind of about institutional issues that the AFL-CIO and the other unions going to be bringing to this session. Diane, you're probably familiar with card check recognition for union elections.
And yes, absolutely.
We'll have that bill again in front of this session. I'm wondering how you feel that'll get handled this time. We got it through the Senate last time. We didn't even get a hearing in the House.
That was such a familiar refrain in the 2005 session.
Right.
Passes the Senate, fails in the House. Excuse me, Representative Rosenbaum. Go ahead.
So, Ken, to answer your question, actually, Larry and I both attended a meeting last week of people from unions across the state who were talking about having a core agenda that really supported workers' right to form a union, and it included other things that you were talking about, you know, at the beginning of the show, like the Worker Freedom Act, which I also think is extremely important. So I think that this is a session where people who are in unions or people who are struggling to try to form unions and find that the deck is stacked against them are going to get definitely a fair hearing and serious consideration of that AFL-CIO agenda. I mean, certainly, and I imagine a lot of your listeners are familiar with this, but probably even more aren't familiar with the fact that, you know, we have elections in this country that are democratic, where everybody has a say, and, you know, we have laws that protect people from being intimidated out of voting or being unfairly influenced at the polling places, everywhere except at the workplace. And I think that it is really a basic democratic right for people who want to just, you know, consider forming a union to be able to say so, and then when a majority of those workers have said, we want a union, we want to affiliate with a particular union, then they have the right to do that democratically. And that really is what the card check proposal for public employees is all about. And beyond that, you know, people may have heard of, in Congress, the Employee Free Choice Act, which establishes some similar rights for workers in the private sector. And as one legislator here in Oregon, but also as president of the National Labor Caucus of state legislators, I am very supportive of the Employee Free Choice Act. I think that at a federal level, we're going to see renewed energy behind that proposal. It already had great bipartisan support, and I think that we may see that move forward, too.
Great.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to KBOO 90.7. Radio in Portland, Oregon, and we're talking to Representative Larry Galizio from House District 35 in the Tigard area, and the incoming Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House of Representatives, Representative Diane Rosenbaum from Southeast Portland.
And, you know, also, Ken had mentioned before that unions have often, well, in the last 16 years, had to play a lot of defense, blocking attempts to attack the minimum wage or prevailing wage, and I think you're right in saying that that's less likely to happen. So the energy can be channeled in progressive reform and doing some of the things that Diane talked about and what we've been talking about here this evening. You know, aside from Diane and myself, we also have representatives Jeff Barker, Paul Holvey, Mike Schaffler, and you'd already mentioned Brad Witt, all in the House, all union members currently or former union members. So I think that's significant. Plus, you have a gentleman named Tim Nesbitt working with the governor and Chip Terhune, and I think that's also very important. And also the labor commissioner, Dan Gardner, I know has quite an extensive, ambitious agenda dealing with a lot of these nuts and bolts issues that are really important to working people.
Great. So. Has your caucus given any thought or consideration to ballot measure reform? Because we all spend a lot of resources and effort fighting really bad ballot measures that can harm our state, and we believe some of them are getting on the ballot through fraudulent collection of signatures.
Well, I'll take a stab at that. I think that it's very clear, looking at the last election cycle, that there was a lot of fraud and violation of the law that voters approved a few years ago, the Initiative Integrity Act, which prohibits paying by the signature for people who go out on the street and collect signatures. And unfortunately, you know, the Secretary of State, I don't think, has adequate tools right now to enforce that law that an overwhelming majority of Oregonians passed back in 2002. So I think we're very, very interested and committed to working with the Secretary of State to beef up the law to make sure that law that's in the Constitution is enforced. The Labor Commissioner also, I think, has been investigating some of those cases where people were not paid an hourly wage if they were out there collecting signatures. And there are a lot of things we can do. One of them would be also having similar requirements for voter registration. Now, right now, it is legal to register voters and pay a bounty for every voter registration card that you collect. And I personally think that that should be prohibited, too, and that, you know, maybe it's okay to pay people an hourly wage to do that, but they shouldn't be being rewarded for collecting so many Democratic registrations and then throwing away all the Republican ones or whatever.
Or vice versa, as the case may be.
Right.
Yeah, and I think if, you know, in states such as Oregon and California, it's difficult to overemphasize how significant ballot measures are. And so I think most Oregonians have the perspective it's kind of mend it, don't end it. There's a lot of reform that needs to take place. I mean, last session I was one of the co-sponsors of a bill that I think has been introduced in the last two or three sessions, which tries to end the practice of so-called ballot title shopping, where you only need 25 signatures to force to trigger the Secretary of State and Attorney General's office to spend a lot of person power and thousands of dollars to come up with different ballot titles, and it's just basically a waste of taxpayer dollars, and it's an attempt to kind of manipulate ballot titles. So there's a lot we can do there.
I think we could do something too around honesty of the signature collectors. I don't know how many times this last year I was approached about signing an initiative to create a rainy day fund, and it was the Tabor fund or the other Measure 41, and you know those were outright lies. And to me, you know, I understood that as I was walking to the Saturday market that somebody was lying to me. But a lot of folks, you know, just decide that they're going to sign those things because they've been told something wrong. So
when we think about economic fairness and issues that really affect working people, I think this struggle of the paycheck to paycheck life, not to change subjects from initiative reform, which I actually think is incredibly important. But one of the issues that came about and that you all dealt with quite handily during the special session of this year was the issue around payday loans. But these predatory lenders are trying to find new ways to gouge working people who are struggling to either to pay their medical bills or just make ends meet from week to week. Any thoughts on the Democratic agenda to deal with predatory lending?
Well, sure. I think that we did pass a law that was a strong one in the April special session. Certainly, you know, there were a number of people that led the fight to try to regulate the payday loan industry and put some limits on predatory lending. That law actually has not taken effect yet. In fact, it won't take effect until July 1st of next year. So one of the things that's been happening is that a lot of these payday loan companies have been restructuring and reformatting themselves and just changing the name of the kinds of usurious loans that are out there. So they'll call them consumer loans instead of payday loans. So I think there will be a comprehensive set of proposals to look at the predatory lending practices. Certainly we'll be upholding and building on the law that we passed in April and make sure that that's not weakened in any way. But I think you'll see a broader set of proposals out there to also go after some of the other types of loans that can have outrageous terms and balloon payments and interest rates. So,
If I can just hop in here also, and just doing some of the research, looking at who takes out these sort of short-term high-interest loans, I was really surprised at the number of college students who wind up doing that. And, you know, obviously there are a variety of reasons why that happens, but, there's financial education is important, but Diane is absolutely right. These folks understand that there is a market there, and it's not being served well by other financial institutions, so there's going to be efforts to kind of restructure themselves. And also we have to look at those check cashing place. Those have little regulation, and they take enormous amounts of money from folks. So I think you're going to see a lot of work in predatory lending this session.
Now that you're in the majority, I have a question about what rules are going to be changed to allow Oregon citizens to have more access to legislative hearings and more input towards the committee process.
That's a great question, Ken. And one of them is providing more notice to the public when hearings get scheduled. We have been calling for 72-hour notice for all hearings, and that's something that we definitely are going to be putting in place. Very often hearings happen on very short notice, and real people have a hard time getting down to the state legislature to begin with, let alone if they don't really have adequate notice. Another is that we will be restoring the right of a majority of members in the House of Representatives to vote on a bill directly on the floor of the House. You might think that's a no-brainer, but actually, last session, one of the big fights we had was that a rule that's existed from time immemorial in Oregon that says that if there are 31 members in the 60-member House who want to vote on a bill and pass it, you can actually take that piece of legislation and force a vote directly on the floor of the House. That rule was actually repealed at the end of the last legislative session in 2005. It was fundamentally undemocratic and shocking, I think, to me and to many, many people who'd been cherishing the democratic institution of the legislature. So we will be restoring that and making sure that that right is protected for Democrats and Republicans and independents and basically for the citizens of Oregon. So those are two that we feel very strongly about.
I think that's great, especially, when you were in the minority, that had to be your only hope, really, is that you could, force the process of getting a vote. And I think that's a great rule change that you folks are making that'll say to the Republicans that they, too, can get some things done, and they just have to work the process, and the process is open.
And I think that is actually one of the most exciting things that we've discussed here tonight, because there were innumerable measures and that members from both sides of the aisle would say, oh yeah, if that comes to the floor, I'll vote for it. But that process of trying to get it to the floor would never have happened. So that's a great way to actually get some debate on some very important issues without people stymieing people's voices. I know that we are coming to a close in terms of our time with you two this evening, and we appreciate you spending so much with us at this, I'm sure, very hectic time. Tell me, do you each want to take a minute and talk about what you'd like to do or what Oregonians can do to engage and keep you all busy down there for more time to come than just 2007?
Well, how about if I start so Diane can finish?
That sounds great, Larry.
Okay. First, I have to say that my goal is to finish grading my final exams, because my students are going to be cranky if I don't get these things out pretty soon. So
indeed,
that's number one on my priority list. But in terms of the the legislative session. We're still sort of waiting to find out what committees we'll be serving on and, you know, where we're sitting on the floor and some of those details, so that's going to be significant. But I think we have a great opportunity here, and we're mindful of the responsibility, and our goal, I know, is to implement the roadmap, what we've talked about in these kinds of investments in infrastructure and people, and to do it in a way that's efficient and intelligent, and end the session in June, and go out and sort of lay the groundwork for future years, so that we remain in the majority and that people have access to health care, better education, and better public safety overall. So that those are the goals.
Well said. Representative Rosenbaum?
Yeah, I think that's a great answer, and I agree with everything Larry said. I also just want to mention that Carolyn Tomei, my colleague who shares the other part of Southeast Portland, and I had a town hall last week in Southeast Portland, and we thought middle of December that we might be lucky to get 50 people there, but we had a standing room only crowd of well over 100 people, including former Governor Barbara Roberts, who just happened to show up as one of our constituents. And people, like I'm sure the listeners of the show tonight, are really clamoring and very excited about there being a new day in Oregon politics. I think that what has happened in this election that just passed at a national and a state level is that people spoke loud and clear that it's not good enough to have a legislature that has gridlock and bickering, but really does not make progress on health care, on education, on the environment. We didn't get much chance tonight to talk about the biofuels proposals that are a huge piece of our agenda. So I just want to really encourage the listeners of KBOO, as well as, you know, everybody else out there, to be sure to come down to Salem starting January 8th. I think that even though it's dark and rainy and gray in January, you will find that sunshine has really started to shine down in the halls of Salem, and that we will be able by next June to say that we accomplished some real progress on the things that matter to everyday Oregonians. I'm very excited about being part of that, and I think that we will start to give people a legislature that they can be proud of again.
Yay-hoo!
Thank you both for being our guests tonight.
Thanks.
Great.
We'll
Thank
do it
you.
Again. Thanks so much.
Great. Good talking to you.
Same.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it really is. How can one not be excited, especially talking to those two members of the legislature? You know, I was debating whether or not, should we ask them something harder? But I felt like, you know, I really want an opportunity to hear about the good things, because I think the reality will set in soon enough. Because just because there's a Democratic majority does not mean that this is easy work at all. And so I would also echo Diane's calls of people getting involved. That just because there's, you know, maybe a better light down there and more sunshine in the Capitol, it actually calls for us to be even more diligent in keeping democracy alive and keeping the legislature moving forward for Oregonians.
Yeah, I think the major change, you know, is one that the average Oregonian can take advantage of. Those folks that manned the phones, you know, made phone calls, canvassed for these elections and helped get these folks elected, now is their opportunity to go to Salem and make a difference. And, you know, we've seen the legislative process. It is possible still in our state for a small, dedicated group of folks to get a bill passed. You know, something that impacts their workplace, their neighborhood, the environment. That can still happen. And what we just heard is the opportunity is greater for those things to happen because the process is going to be more open. Representative Rosenbaum talked about 72-hour notice of hearings on bills.
That is such a huge difference than 24 hours if we were lucky.
Yeah, I mean, 24-hour notice was the supposed rule, but towards the end of session it gets down to a half hour or 45-minute notice of a hearing on a bill, and that locks out Oregon citizens. The other change so that a majority of House members could actually call for a vote on a bill, that encourages bipartisan work between people from both parties and independents, that they can get a bill moved by working together with the other side. So that also is a major improvement and can be taken advantage of by our labor movement and by working class folks. So I do look forward to a lot of good things in this session.
Yes, elections are not the end of the work, Ken. I think they are the beginning of the work.
Right, and this is a very easy legislature to access. You can, for those people that are internet savvy, you can go online and communicate by email with your legislators. They still take phone calls and hold meetings with constituents, most of them in Salem. So I'd encourage that same kind of election activity and excitement that we had, you know, a month ago can be translated into the legislative excitement. When Representative Rosenbaum and Galizio talk about, you know, health care for all children, there's going to be a look at comprehensive health care for all Oregonians. That's exciting stuff, and it's stuff that we couldn't consider doing for the last 16 years. When you think about, you know, 600,000 uninsured Oregonians, that we have a window of opportunity now to close that window and get health care for all Oregonians. I've talked to any number of working people in the last couple of years. They've been locked out of the system. They may work for an employer that they could get health care for their children if they had $300 a month to contribute, but on $9.50 an hour, there's no way they're going to have that $300. This is a golden opportunity. We should all take advantage of it.
I agree. And if listeners would like more information on the roadmap that we spoke about with Representative Galizio and Representative Rosenbaum, please check out their website at www.roadmapfororegon.com, and it'll list out all the issues around health care, education, predatory lenders, corporate polluters, and their agenda for 2007. And quite frankly, it's our responsibility to then hold these elected officials accountable to do the work that they said that they would do. Now, if they were all like Diane and Larry, I don't think we would have any issues, but it's still a process of negotiation.
You know, the other thing we'll do on our program is sometime mid-session and then toward the end of the session, we'll have some of these labor legislators back on our show to talk about what is getting accomplished, what they see as the goals for the rest of the session, and that's the way we can hold them accountable to our listeners, is bringing them back on, letting them say what they've accomplished so far, what else is going to get done, and that kind of pressure needs to be put on them to make it happen.
And if folks want to learn more about the AFL-CIO legislative agenda, is that oraflcio.org? Or org?
I think it's .com.
I think it's .com as well. And so we would encourage people to do that. And if folks want to see what's happening in healthcare reform, please check out the website for the organization that I work for, OregonianSforHealthSecurity.org.
And if you want to check, for AFSCME members that are listening, if you want to check out what we're doing, OregonAFSCME.com. There's links on all of our websites to how you can link into the legislature, too, and send letters to legislators. Those letters get read, phone calls get heard, and if you want to make something happen, you need to participate in the process.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So as we think about our wishes for the new year, Ken, anything on your wish list?
My wish is for a legislature that accomplishes a lot for working people, and that's a big wish, but I think we can accomplish that.
I agree, and I will take that wish as well as have another one, which is the ability for this legislature to work and get out by June 30th will be a beautiful thing, and I think will really show Oregonians that Democrats can deliver and work for Oregonians. So it'll be a great day.
I want to thank Ben, our engineer, and we'll be back in January with another show on Labor Radio. And
happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers Shopmen's Local 516 and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.